Happy New Year's Eve, and welcome to KUOW's Year in Review. I'm Bill Radke. 2015 is fading, and you're going to make the most of what's left this hour with the host of Public Radio's Live Wire, Luke Burbank. Hey, Luke.
Hello there, Bill.
Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo, welcome back.
Hello.
Former Washington State Attorney General Rob McKenna, good to see you again.
Likewise, thanks.
I think what defined 2015 to most people around Seattle was the boom times. That means the growth, the building, the traffic congestion, the prices, the income inequality, the changes. As we're calling it at KOW, we are the region of boom. In fact, in case you're not following our Region of Boom series, which is a real thing, we'll tweet a link to it right now so you can catch up on these reports. They're all about how we are changing, whether you like it or not. So let's start there. Do we like it or not? Rob McKenna, you've lived here since you were a kid. Did the Seattle area improve this year or get worser?
Oh, it definitely improved. Anytime unemployment goes down and income goes up, we're all better off as a whole. That doesn't mean there
aren't
problems. Well, the income on average, particularly for people living in King County, if you live in Grays Harbor County or you live in Cowlitz County down in Longview, it's a different story. But here in Central Puget Sound, where most of your listeners live, on average, people were doing better and had more opportunities for jobs and better paying jobs. So overall, that's a good thing. And now, of course, we're dealing with the side effects of prosperity, like traffic and higher housing prices. So those have to be addressed.
But overall, envy of the nation.
I think that's pretty clear. And not only that, but think about it as being the envy of the world. There's a great book came out a few years ago by Jim Clifton, who runs Gallup, called The Coming Jobs War. And it, what it's about is the competition globally for good paying jobs, because, you know, a couple of billion people don't have a job. They live hand to mouth. And their countries are working very, very hard to bring jobs to their homeland so they have a chance to earn an income. We have that in abundance here in the Seattle area, and I don't think we should take it for granted.
Ijeoma, you're from here too.
Yes.
Better or worse in 2015? Rob McKenna says side effects, yes, but far better.
Oh, you know, I think it's really hard. I think that the security of having a strong economy and, you know, having jobs in the region is always wonderful. But I don't think that we've been responsible with it. And I think this has definitely been a bad year for the soul of Seattle.
What do you mean, the soul of Seattle?
You know, when we see these housing prices going up as high as they have, when we see our homelessness rate skyrocketing the way it has, when we see, you know, the amount of strife and how disenfranchised our immigrant communities and people of color in Seattle feel, it's very obvious that that security and that prosperity is only going to certain people in the city. And it's definitely changing what Seattle is and who Seattle is for. And I think that this was a year where a lot of people felt like they were less a part of Seattle than they were before.
What about that, Rob? Great for certain people, heartbreaking for people without means.
Well, I mean, as a general rule, a rising tide really does raise all boats, because everyone has more and better opportunities than they did before. All you have to do is think about what it was like during the depths of the recession, and what high unemployment looks like and feels like, and what that does to demands on social services and incidents of violence, domestic violence, et cetera. And then go back even farther and think about, you know, the deep dark times in this area. Like, my sister moved here during the Boeing bust in the early 70s. It was really, really bad. People were, you know, losing their jobs by the thousands. They were losing their homes. So I agree. There are a lot of things that need to be better. And disenfranchisement of new arrivals, immigrants, is a good example of that. At the same time, one of the factors that's driving change and the feeling that things are changing in this community is large numbers of people who are arriving here to work for Amazon.com, to work for Microsoft, et cetera. I heard a number the other day. I haven't verified it, but someone told me that 6,000 new people a month are moving into King County. And they're moving here because they can come here to work. So that is definitely going to have an effect. This is not going to be our parents' Seattle. And then we have an obligation, I think, to address the problems that we've just heard about people feeling alienated, for example.
Okay, we'll talk about addressing that in a moment. Luke Burbank, I assume you think Seattle is rotting, and that's why you keep moving farther and farther away?
That's right. I join you all today from Bellingham, the Tijuana of Canada, so that I could bring home the point that, I mean, for my money and for my experience, I do not think Seattle is becoming a more livable place anyway. And maybe it's because I haven't lived in Seattle in a couple of years, but every time I enter Seattle, I am reminded of the things that made it really difficult for me to live there, including the traffic, which I feel is just impassable. I was going to an event at Town Hall a month ago, and I had to be there at 6 for the whatever sound check thing. I got to Northgate Mall at 4 o'clock, and I barely made it to Town Hall by 6 o'clock. That's just one person's story of traffic, which I know is not that interesting. But when I'm in Seattle, I feel like it's really hard to get around if you're using a car. I have friends who can't buy houses there, and they're not the have-nots. They're people with good jobs. I saw a story in the Times this week about a group of friends from Burning Man who went in on a house together. It was like a $700,000 house in Columbia City. You could buy Columbia City for $700,000 like 5 years ago. I made an offer. It was turned down. But, I mean, that was the range we're talking about. So, I mean, I don't think this is a decision anyone's made. I think this is what happens with big cities when they become prosperous. You also can't live in Manhattan unless you're rich. You can't live in most of San Francisco unless you're rich. That's what's happening in Seattle. I think Rob was right when he said it's not our parents' Seattle. But to me, it's not a better Seattle.
But if you, yes, you can't afford to live in Manhattan. I can't afford to live in Medina. If what's wrong with areas changing as they always have so that people keep moving to the places where they can afford to move and not where they can't afford to move?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. Again, I don't think there's some sort of Mr. Burns-esque character who's plotting to make this happen. I just think it's the effect of a city. But for instance, you talk about a place like New York, Manhattan, at least below a certain street, is pretty soulless now. So I think if the question is Seattle a better place? Is Seattle a more interesting place? I would argue it is getting less interesting as the people become more affluent and, frankly, more white.
But Igioma, does that just mean Shoreline is more interesting where you live, or this isn't just a conversation about the city of Seattle, but the suburbs are Bell, you know, go to Crossroads and whether you speak Ukrainian or Farsi or what, you know, that we're just this is becoming a more interesting region in different places. Is that a bad thing?
You know, I think that if, you know, the Seattle area were more diverse in general, it wouldn't necessarily be as bad a thing. But this is one of the whitest major cities in the country, and we're really being pushed. People of color are being pushed out of the city. They're being dispersed even further. And when you are an extreme minority in the population and you're being pushed from your homes, you're being pushed from any sort of collective community out to wherever you can afford to be, you know, I can't gather all of the artists of color in Seattle anymore because they don't live in Seattle anymore. They live in Renton. They live in Shoreline. They live everywhere else. We're spread out. There's no sense of community. There's no everything that we built that made Seattle attractive, right? You know, and it was, let's not forget, the forced ghettoization of people of color in Seattle that made a lot of these neighborhoods, you know, like the Rainier Beach neighborhood, desirable in the first place, right? Because that's where you had a high concentration of these artists and creators and people with rich cultural heritage coming together. That's what made these places desirable. And it's what brought all of the wealthy white people into those areas and then shoved those very same people out. So yeah, we don't have enough to be spread out. And I feel like, you know, yeah, Shoreline's going to become hip. We're getting more coffee shops. And eventually the people here who make this place livable won't be able to afford to live there too. And we're just going to continue to be chased further and further away from the city that we love.
Yeah. So Rob, it's not just people moving. It's atomization. It's the end of community. It's a diaspora of people.
Well, it's true. At the same time, the greater Seattle area, the region, is becoming more diverse. A lot of that has to do with immigration as well as people moving internally within King County or between King County, Pearson, and Snohomish County. You know, I live in Bellevue. I've lived there since I was in high school in the late 70s. At one point, the census tract, which we call Crossroads, it was the most diverse census tract in the state of Washington, more diverse than any one place in Seattle. It continues to be highly diverse. You alluded to the Crossroads Mall, where if I go there as a Caucasian, I'm nearly always in the minority. No, I'm always in the minority these days, and I think that's delightful. It reminds me of living on the south side of Chicago and having that same experience, which is incredibly enlightening for a person who's used to being in the majority. So in the communities like Bellevue, Issaquah, Sammamish, Shoreline, rent, and et cetera, you have increasing diversity. And it's not just diverse ethnically, it's also diverse economically. We have a lot of people who are also wealthy coming in and moving their families into Bellevue to get into the schools, moving their families to Issaquah for the same reason, or they're coming in to Sammamish because they're working at Microsoft or they're working for another company. So it's a very complex situation, right? A lot of people from very different backgrounds. Some come here with no means. They're immigrating, fleeing violence, for example, in South America or in the Horn of Africa. Others come here to pursue tremendous economic opportunities who are very highly educated. But all of it, I think, improves our area in the sense that it increases our overall diversity and it creates a lot of these people are coming here and creating economic opportunity for themselves or working for people who are.
Okay, so Rob McKenna, you said you wanted to address inequality. You've said we need to improve our education system, our transportation system. So if you had won the governor's race, you would be lobbying taxpayers for more money for education and transportation right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we aren't the state is not funding basic education currently. That's what the Supreme Court pointed out, 9-0. That was an obvious outcome from that case because the legislature had been raising the bar for basic education spending and then wasn't meeting it, wasn't actually providing adequate funds. But in addition to funding, we're not getting the results that we need. We rank among, I think it's the bottom 10 states now, in terms of producing graduates from high school across the state who are ready for work or for higher education. We're not getting the results that we need for those kids.
Luke, what do you want this place to be? What's the ideal? What should happen in 2016? Or are you just going to move to Alaska?
I mean, I'm working on it. As soon as I'm allowed back in Canada, it's currently what's impeding me from getting there. I mean, I guess I want what is sort of a fantasy. I'm reminded of when I lived in the Bryant neighborhood over sort of near Laurelhurst. And I was talking to an older neighbor of mine. I was renting a house, and she was talking about the neighborhood, and she was saying, oh, that's where Bill lived. He was a butcher, and that's where Michael was. He was a postman. And it blew my mind that people with normal jobs were able to own homes in this neighborhood because that was no longer the case. I would like to see a city where people who aren't making a lot of money don't have to take four buses and spend an extra 2 hours in each direction trying to get to their work. Because they're already working hard, they're already not probably making enough money, and this is less time they can spend with their family. I would like to see that happen. I don't really know how it happens. My wife and I are fortunate in that we have mobility, in that I do weird jobs like this where I can join you from my house in Bellingham. A lot of people don't have that mobility. They got to go to where their job is, but they got to live farther and farther away from where that's happening, and I think that's really unfortunate.
So at least more transit. Before we wrap up, Ijeoma, 2016, what's your ideal? What do you want for that? We've been talking this last 15 minutes about the region of boom, a lot of the upsides and downsides. What do you want?
I want the citizens of Seattle to commit to community. And in committing to community, not committing to a community of people just like them, I want people to commit to economic diversity in their communities and to actually see these.
What would that look like? How do I commit to economic diversity in my community?
I think you commit to economic diversity by pushing for, you know, diverse housing options, by not immediately tearing down, you know, every older home and putting in expensive new homes, by, you know, funding education more equitably so that children of, you know, families of any income are getting a high quality education, by improving our public transportation so that people who don't have cars can afford to stay where they're at and get to their jobs. You know, all of these things, by saying basically we care about Seattle and we care about the fact we want Seattle to have artists and we want Seattle to have laborers and we want Seattle to have entrepreneurs and we want tech in Seattle. We want all of these things in Seattle. We don't want to create Seattle in the image of, you know, every new Amazon employee. We want them to become a part of Seattle and to be just as invested in Seattle as those of us who have been here a long time are. And also the people who have been here a long time need to start treating this with the urgency that it should be treated with. And instead of just waiting for it to hit their street and hit their town and then go, where did everybody go? We need to start investing in how we fund our cities and the way that in which we support all of our neighbors in the Seattle area.
Supporting community, supporting diversity. And I just want to point out how much agreement there has been these last few minutes about education funding, educational opportunity, public transportation. across the board.
It must be the sunshine. I'm personally like experiencing a contact high from seeing the sun after like 3 months.
So. Right.
I think Rob is just remembering that I actually endorsed him. It's probably the first Republican I've endorsed in a long time. So there's a lot of
love, that you, man. Love
the
you.
Comedy and this show is palpable.
Did you get the ham that I sent you?
I did. Thank you. It was delicious.
I think I sent it to Port Townsend though.
Yeah. We will spiral cut that ham to the bone in the remaining portion of our year in review. We're going to talk about race. We're going to talk fear. We're going to talk Russell. We're going to talk about some goodbyes in the remaining hour. Stay tuned. KUOW Seattle, you're about to put up the free 2016 calendar that you got in the mail from the Humane Society or the Parks Foundation, and you didn't even send them a donation, but you're still using their calendar. I'm Bill Radke. We are reliving 2015 with Igioma Oluo, Rob McKenna, and Luke Burbank. The President of the United States has told us we have got to do something that might make you feel uncomfortable, but it is long overdue.
Over the coming year, I want to lead the American people in a great and unprecedented conversation about race. We have talked at each other and about each other for a long time. It's high time we all began talking with each other.
Yes, it is high time, President Clinton. And after 18 years, we've kind of had that conversation this year, including in Seattle, where Bernie Sanders got his Westlake rally interrupted.
So right now, we're going to honor this space. And we are going to honor the memory of Michael Brown. And we are going to honor all of the black lives lost this year. And we're going to honor the fact that I have to fight through all these people to say, my life matters. That I have to get up here in front of a bunch of screaming white racists to say my life matters. My life matters.
To a mix of cheers and boos, that was Marissa Johnson at the Seattle Bernie Sanders rally in August. There were also demonstrations from students of color at the University of Washington and Western Washington University. Even the Spokane NAACP leader Rachel Dolezal got us talking about race, for better or worse. Igioma, you write professionally about race, among other things. What did you think of how Washington's 2015 race conversation was?
I'm just so glad that we're finally having it. You know, it was a painful year, I think, especially for white Seattle, but also, you know, for people of color. I think it was a constant affirmation of what we already knew, which was that this was happening and simmering in our communities. The racial separation in Seattle is very strong and very silent. And to finally be able to talk about it and to finally get those emotions out there and confront that fear that so many people in Seattle have about talking about these difficult things. You know, Seattle, I would say our number one privilege that we prioritize above all else is comfort here. And it's very uncomfortable to talk about race. So it was really wonderful and very, very difficult to have these conversations. It was heartbreaking every time to see the amount of pushback, to see how hard people who, you know, claim to be beyond race would fight to not talk about race in Seattle and not talk about the ways in which we really are separated here. But we're finally talking about it, and we've continued talking about it. So I think that this was a very important year. I'm so glad that we can actually get this aired out. And a lot of people are taking really hard looks at themselves this year that they weren't doing before.
Give me an example of what makes you believe that this, you call it the cracking veneer of Seattle liberals, this discomfort, these conversations, what makes you believe this is going to stick, this is going to be productive going forward?
You know, I think that shedding light on systemic issues in society will always be a positive. And the fact that we are still talking about it, you know, we're at the end of the year. And this is definitely something that I think in the past could easily have been a news bite. You know, Bernie Sanders' speech could have easily been something that by the end of the month was forgotten. But here we are, you know, 6 months later, still talking about it. And we're talking about it because people are still having those conversations. And when we see things, you know, like in Western, my sister actually just graduated from Western. And when you see the threats that they had at the school there recently that shut down school for a day, and, you know, seeing them confront what has been happening, you know, around for a long time, and seeing, you know, even my 22-year-old sister say, you know, this is enough and I should be able to go to school and not worry for my life. And we're still having these conversations. And I think that it's about time that we stopped viewing ourselves as being exempt. You know, every time this national conversation around race happens, we like to think, oh, thank goodness we don't live in the South. Thank goodness we don't live in these, you know, heavily segregated areas. Oh, my goodness, Seattle is so segregated. You know, it's one of those cities I could walk around and not see a person of color if I wished to very easily. And this is my home. And I think this is the first time I've ever felt like it really could be more of my home, because we're actually talking about these things and addressing these things that people of color have dealt with, you know, their entire time here.
Wow. As you've lived here a long time, that's powerful, I think, that you are feeling something so different. Luke Burbank, how do you react to that? What do you think of our 2015 conversation?
I think it was a really necessary year when it comes to race and talking about it. I think, you know, when I listened to that the tape of the young women breaking in on the Bernie Sanders speech, I don't necessarily feel like it had to be that way or that was the best way to handle it. But I also feel like I can totally understand why somebody would see that as their only option, somebody who happens to be African-American. I think like a lot of conversations that happen in our actual relationships, like with the people we love, there is a lot of times a conversation that needs to happen that is going to be awkward, and there's a lot of feelings, and maybe both sides are going to say things that they don't totally mean or they haven't completely thought through, because there's a lot of emotion behind it. But after you have one of those conversations, it's very cathartic, and I think it's really important. And I think that's what we've been having happen in the Northwest over the last year, and I think it's been really positive. I've spent a lot of time in different parts of the country, and I think Seattleites are very interesting, because white Seattleites are probably would self-report as the most okay with people of color, and then would also be the most likely to lock their car door if an African-American man with a sign approached them as they were getting off of Aurora at Denny or whatever. I just think it's probably to some degree because the white people in Seattle don't rub elbows and spend time in close proximity with as many African-Americans. I'll mention those people of color because of the Black Lives Matter movement. I don't necessarily even think it's because white people in the Northwest want to be uncomfortable around people of color, but I just don't think we're as used to it as in some other parts of the country.
We're being very positive here, but you bring up the example of the Bernie Sanders rally where we heard a lot of booing. And you know, the potential downside of venting your words of anger, as you say, is a bitterness and, you know, backlash. Rob McKenna, any danger of that?
I don't know why those people were booing unless some of them didn't like the message, which is possible even for that crowd. It could also be some of them resented having the event interrupted. They had come down to attend. No one likes to see one person's free speech trampled on so that another person can exercise their free speech rights. But I'm conflicted about this because I also think what we witnessed was an act of civil disobedience. In a sense, I think it was pretty much what it wasn't civil disobedience in the sense of breaking the law, but in the sense of breaking social norms, which say, you know, you stand back and it's their microphone, it's their event, you don't interrupt.
Isn't that a proud tradition, civil disobedience?
Oh, it is. That's my point. And I hadn't thought about it as civil disobedience until afterward. I was kind of reflecting on it, thinking, what did we really just see? And the young woman who took over that microphone clearly thought that was the only way they could get their message out, because if they'd had their own rally afterward, no one would attend. The same people would not have hung around to hear that message then. And so they committed an act of civil disobedience in order to get their message out, to make people uncomfortable, in order to have a conversation that was sustained and sustainable. So I think Ijeoma is right that if it hadn't been for that act, we would not still be talking about it today.
I'm curious whether you all think this was important in 2015 or a regrettable footnote or something in between, which is Rachel Dolezal, who's this NAACP leader in Spokane. I see Ijeoma holding her forehead in her hand. Does that mean you would rather turn the page on the name Rachel Dolezal?
You know, it was just being someone who spends most of her time talking on the internet and dealing with trolls, this was just, I mean, this was every white supremacist troll's dream. And black people, especially black women, were so harmed by this. And I don't think that's something that most of white America understood, how harmful it was to see a white woman come in and be like, I'm black. And if people be like, yeah, she looks black. And to really reduce black womanhood to a curly perm and a spray tan was incredibly offensive, and it actually really did a lot of harm for the identity of black women across America. I think that's something we didn't talk about a lot, but black women were very, very hurt by this. Also, the amount of harm this discussion did to our transgender community, because people started using, conflating transracial with transgender and saying, well, if, you know, a man can be a woman, then why can't a white person be a black person? And that was so delegitimizing for both the experience of race in America and what it actually means, but also to, you know, trans men and women who are already, you know, battling so hard to be accepted for who they are. So I don't think anything positive came from the Rachel Dolezal thing. And the fact that she's still being interviewed as some sort of sideshow, the fact that it still makes race into this mockery of this costume that you can put on. You can't put on, you know, the thing about Rachel Dolezal, I could never be white, right? There is no amount of hair straightening that can make me white. Whiteness is a definition of exclusion. Right. It's a definition of purity. And this undermined our whole structure of race and what race really is, which race is really you have whiteness and then you have not whiteness. And for her to be able to just come down and pretend to be white for a while and wear it like a costume, it's a long tradition in America of, you know, wearing Native American headdresses for Halloween and acting like you know something about being Native American. And it reduced us to hair texture and skin tone, and I do not see anything positive that came from it.
Luke, you feel any differently?
Well, I'm on the far, far outside of this as a white guy, but it seemed to me that the reaction maybe would have been different if Rachel Dolezal would have at least clarified, I was born Caucasian, but I feel that I am somehow you know, transracial on the interior of my body. That might have been a slightly different conversation as opposed to trying to actually deceive people about the, you know, the state of her melatonin when she was born, I guess. But this is the question I wanted to ask Ijeoma, and I really don't ask this to try to conflate things. It's because I really am trying to wrap my mind around it exactly. When you mentioned the way that this was damaging to the trans community, I guess my understanding of gender fluidity and of the trans movement would be somebody might say, I was born physically in one body, but I feel differently. I identify as differently. How is that different than someone saying, I am racially born in one body, but I feel in the interior of myself different?
You know, it's different in a couple of ways. One, which is that it only goes one way, right? Like I said, I could never actually become a white person. And there's no way I could walk through this world as a white person. Also, you know, I mean, this is definitely something I would say I would highly recommend that people from the trans community, if they feel like answering, because this is a question that hurts them to answer, because, you know, their experience is their own. But also it's one of those things where, you know, race is an economic construct of oppression that's been set up, and you can't move out of blackness. Now, when you decide, like, I was, you know, biologically assigned male at birth, and I'm going to become female. When you
but decide, isn't even the statement when you decide that running counter to the notion that a person is born how they are? It's not really a decision whether that's gender fluidity or something else.
Well, no, because when you think about, you know, race being a social construct, it's also, though, a product of your entire history and your entire heritage, right? Being born black doesn't just mean I'm born with dark skin. Being born black also means that, you know, my parents suffered certain discriminations. It means that, you know, economically I'm set at a certain disadvantage. And it also means that if I were to decide something else, I can't actually shed that. If I were, you know, let's say a trans male and became male, the maleness in many ways, it does open up to me and I can actually achieve that and be that. And, you know, when we look at gender and what gender really is and how it's much more than a binary anyways, right? Even just talking about in terms of male and female, there's so much more to gender than that. And it's so much wider spread than that. You know, if we had the opportunity to remove the constructs around race, right? And where race was something where we could say, I am something in between and economically and socially and all of those things followed along with it, then yeah, it would be fairly similar. But it's not.
Ijeoma, can I speak for some well-meaning white people
yeah.
for a moment? You brought up the idea that race is a construct. So this is what I think a lot of well-meaning white people wanted to come out of the Rachel Dolezal situation. This I'm going to give you two quotes. This is the African-American writer Jelani Cobb writing about Rachel Dolezal in The New Yorker. Quote, Dolezal has been dressed precisely as we all are in a fictive garb of race whose determinations are as arbitrary as they are damaging. This doesn't mean that Dolezal wasn't lying about who she is. It means that she was lying about a lie. So race is fundamentally a fiction. This is Rachel Dolezal. Quote, people are operating on an autopilot that race is coded in your DNA, that there are different races of human beings, and those races are called black, white, etc. Race is not a biological reality. It's a hierarchical system that was created to leverage power and privilege between different groups of people. And I think there were a lot of well-meaning white people who are hoping that we could say, as you did, that being able to lie about your race is a privilege. We can talk about institutional racism and inequities and educational disparities and police misconduct, and also despite whether this woman is a liar, a thief, mentally ill, whatever, we don't know her, but we could also talk about how can we get past our black-white obsession,
mm-hmm.
right? That was the hope, I think.
You know, I think the one thing that many people of color would agree with me on is you don't move past that by, once again, taking what little people of color have and making it accessible to whiteness. You move past it by actually removing the structure that upholds race. Race is the end product of an economic system designed to keep certain people at top and certain people at the bottom. And you don't wish it away. You don't dress it away. You get rid of it by actually dismantling the entire system. When we don't have a system that puts certain people in these categories above each other, then this conversation doesn't matter. But as long as we have a system where the heritage you were born into does determine your standing in the world, it determines your ability to survive interactions with police, it determines your net worth as a person, we can't just say suddenly, well, you know, our quickest way to get from A to Z is to let white people pretend to be that person for the day. It doesn't get rid of the system, because Rachel Dolezal is still, she had to manufacture her own hate crimes, you know, and she was doing that. She was sending herself threats to legitimize her blackness. And I think if that comes to the core of it, where no matter how she dressed up, she could not manufacture the actual oppression that comes with that system. And unless you're going to actually dismantle the system,
okay.
you know, all you're trying to do is dismantle the end result. But you need to actually pull that system apart.
Okay, so then let's end this, because we're going to talk about other things, but let's end on the idea of dismantling the system. Again, I go to an attorney general, a would-be governor. Is there anything about the system of racial inequity that you would want to dismantle with the levers of power?
Well, I think the only way to dismantle it is to continue to make progress to create economic opportunity, educational opportunities, to help people overcome what's been holding them back, which is typically a lack of those opportunities. I don't see any other solution. I mean, one of the important things about the conversation we're having today, and we've been having in 2015, is that we kind of plateaued for a long period of time, thinking, okay, well, we passed the Civil Rights Act, passed the Voting Rights Act, you know, Brown v. Board of Education passed, so everything's going to fix itself. But of course, it doesn't all happen automatically. So having the conversation, identifying specific barriers is really important, because it's fairly granular. You've got to figure out what are the constructs that you want to dismantle, what are the specific pieces. Lack of educational opportunity to me is one of the most important of those, because in the modern economy, it's all about human capital and upskilling. And if you don't have a good education, you are never going to have the level of economic success that you need. And that's important, because because it gives you the means to pursue other things that are important, whether it's sending your kids to art school or sending your kids to the College of Engineering. So that's how I would do it. I mean, it's clear there are still problems, as much progress as we've made, and yet as a society we're failing to address tremendous weaknesses and shortcomings in our public education system, for example, that are holding a lot of those folks back.
We need to put a pause on our 2015 year in review. That's Rob McKenna, former Attorney General. We're with Luke Burbank and Ijeoma Oluo, and we are going to finish talking about 2015 with fear, football, and farewell, so stay tuned. It's New Year's Eve, and this is KUOW's Year in Review. I'm Bill Radke. 2015 was supposedly a year of fear, fear of terrorism, fear of Muslims, fear of immigrants, fear of police shootings. In the Pacific Northwest, fear of earthquakes.
We're talking about absolute devastation within that area. I mean, essentially no structures and certainly no people who are within the inundation zone are going to get out okay.
That was New Yorker writer Catherine Schultz, whose article titled "The Really Big One" produced much pants wetting around here. Now, the really big one did not happen in 2015, although thousands of people felt a 4.8 quake Tuesday night near San Juan, not far from Luke Burbank. Did you feel it?
I absolutely did, but I was already in bed. My wife was watching TV in the other room, and my choice was investigate the earthquake or stay in bed, and I chose stay in bed.
That's the same thing Vaughn Palmer told us. At the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network, John Vidali wondered whether this was a case of slow slip, which is when the earth moves over several weeks instead of seconds. Slow slip happened right before the huge 2011 quake off Japan, and there was slow slip under Vancouver Island over the past week.
We wonder about that, since the slow slip does load the part of the subduction zone that we expect to deliver a magnitude 9 earthquake someday. But it's complicated, so it's something we're studying pretty carefully.
You can hear the terror in his voice. His voice was quaking, but the earthquake that was happening as he spoke canceled out his vocal tremors, making him sound placid. Now, since none of you moved away from the Northwest after the New Yorker article, I presume that means you have no earthquake fear, Luke? Is that right?
Well, fortunately, after that article came out, and I was very, very nervous, as were a lot of people, there were just enough people on KUOW saying it might not be a big thing that I had a little crack of light to go back to my total complacency. And that
so
was
you're putting the guilt on us if all goes horribly wrong.
Essentially, yeah, mm-hmm. You guys and Bill Steele. Mm-hmm. I felt when I heard that it was not going to send a 500-foot wall of water into, 10, 20 miles into the interior of the state, that made me feel a little better, mm-hmm. because I don't live in Grays Harbor County or one of the places that will be potentially swamped. And then also the math on how overdue we are for the earthquake, I heard some revisions on that in terms of probability and stuff. And so like most people, I think I just got just enough to allow me to go back to my normal life.
Yeah, you're looking for just enough. That is so true. Now, that New Yorker writer, Catherine Schultz, she said she no longer spends the night. She'll go to the coast, but she doesn't fall asleep on the coast since writing this article. Rob Ijeoma, did either of you actually come to fear earthquakes either then or now?
It makes you uncomfortable, right, to hear the news, to be reminded that we live in an earthquake-prone area. But at the same time, because major earthquakes are so infrequent, it's impossible as a human being to maintain that level of anxiety that would be required for me to relocate. It's just not possible. It just doesn't happen often enough. And this is I'm speaking as someone who was a kid, lived in California for a couple of years. I vividly recall the Nisqually earthquake when I was on top of one of the oldest, most least safe buildings in downtown Seattle, swaying back and forth. But it's so infrequent that, like everyone else, I'm just playing the odds.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think if I was going to go to the coast, I'd be more comfortable sleeping there. I'd rather go in my sleep. I don't want to see.
That's an excellent point.
I don't want to see that wall of water coming to me. I would much rather be dreaming about, fame and fortune and then just happen to, slip into eternity. It's, I was terrified. Everyone was scared for a while. What was interesting to me, actually, was how much more scared people outside of Seattle were. Like, I had so many more people going,
"Are you okay?
Oh, yeah, are you going to move? Oh, my goodness." But, where am I going to move? Where are we going to go? Where are we going to go that's safe from something? Probably the most boring place in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, there's something that's going to get everyone.
Besides, for those of us who were born during the Cuban Missile Crisis, this is like, you know, we're just like total nuclear annihilation is what our parents were worried about.
So. You know, since you bring that up, yes, I also vaguely remember thousands of missiles being pointed at us, right? And that was the fear of my youth. We had the terrorist attacks in France, and then we had, to some people, the killings at a San Bernardino office party showed that, you know, none of us is safe from radicalized jihadists. But the level of fear, the way it's talked about, feels about like we only can talk about it as at one level, and people seem to equate the two. Rob McKenna, are you really, really any more worried about terrorists than you were a year ago?
No, not in the sense that I think my personal risk has increased, because I think the odds of being a victim are as low as they've been for a long time. Or maybe they're a little higher, but it's such a small statistical increase that I'm still 99.999% safe, right?
But some folks in your party speak differently about it.
Well, they do, because there are plenty of people in the world who like to exploit fears, and they're wrong when they do that, especially when they cast aspersions on the Muslim community in this country. At the same time, there are certainly parts of the world which are clearly less safe. Ask people who have been fleeing Syria, for example. I mean, it's horrific what's happening there and what the destabilization in that region has produced in terms of human suffering and death. Here in the United States, though, all the numbers show that we are safer than we were before as a whole. In terms of violence or the risk of being killed in a violent attack. So, you know, being a rationalist, I tend to think about those facts while at the same time think about what can we do to stop the incidents that are occurring.
Does anyone behave any differently, avoid the Westlake Christmas tree or the Space Needle fireworks or any of that stuff?
I avoid that stuff, but it's just because I'm getting older and I don't like being around people. But there's no danger that I perceive of being in a crowd. I agree with Rob and the rationalists of the world. I think that if you're living in the U.S., your chances of dying in a terrorist attack are incredibly low. And the fact that it's apparently the most primary issue now in this presidential election that's shaping up, at least in the current polls, as far as what people are concerned about, is just really dispiriting to me. I mean, we make these rules. We do this security theater at the airport where they're confiscating an old lady's PERT Plus because it makes us feel like we're doing something to this, what I think of as a non-extant threat. I just think it's unfortunate that so many Americans have bought into it.
Well, at the same time, let's not be complacent. I mean, you know, 9/11 was an event a lot of us watched unfold in real time on the news channels.
But the question is what we should do differently because of it.
Well, the answer to that is you can't let down your guard. You can't become less vigilant. So I don't take for granted the fact that we're relatively safe here. We're obviously advantaged by the borders or by the oceans on both the ends of our country in a way that the Europeans are not. And we also have been putting a lot of time, energy, and resources into security measures that are aimed at detecting and thwarting terrorist attacks before they occur. They don't always succeed, as we saw in Boston, as we saw in San Bernardino. But there have been a number of cases where people have been disrupted before they've been able to carry out a plan to commit an act of terror. And there are other sources of violence as well that have to be addressed, mass shootings, for example, and random single acts of violence. But in terms of terror, I feel safe, but it doesn't mean I take for granted the fact I can feel that way, because I know there are a lot of people who work very hard to keep me that way.
Igioma, is there anything you actually did fear in 2015?
Yes. I mean, I think I definitely fear this nation's reaction to terrorism far more than terrorism. The amount of hatred, the body count that we have in response to any acts of terror, all of these things that we do around the world to, quote unquote, keep America safe, are things that my sons are going to have to pay for with these generations of people overseas who have been absolutely destroyed by our actions. So that terrifies me a lot, because if I felt like right now we would pay for it now, I would actually be less terrified than thinking of the fact that, you know, by the time that my 8-year-old son is an adult, he's going to be growing up with people who saw their parents get murdered by drone strikes, and he's going to have to deal with those repercussions that he had no part in. So that terrifies me a lot. I'm definitely terrified of the cops this year. You know, when we talk about terrorism for Black people in America, for Native American people in America, you know, the biggest you know, we had over 1,000 people murdered by cops this year. And that's what I'm scared of. I'm scared of getting a ticket. I'm scared of being pulled over. I'm far more likely to end up dead in that situation than by any quote unquote terrorist in this country.
Before we move on, is there anything you do, any of you, to be less afraid in 2016? I mean, let's give a little hope or a little solution here. What do you do to be less afraid?
Yeah, there's so much more technology available that can keep us safer, you know, whether it's a sprinkler system in a new house or better smoke alarms, and especially better technology in cars, which has dramatically reduced the death rate from accidents. And the other thing that's helping is that I notice this among my kids. I have kids in their 20s and one who's 16, and I notice how much more responsible they are about alcohol and driving than people who I grew up with were. We were a lot likelier to drive under the influence because that's what people did. And these kids just don't seem to do that. They will call up and say, "I'm spending the night at a friend's. I'm not at a friend's house. I'm not in a good enough shape to drive, or I'm going to take Uber, or a friend who's sober is going to give me a ride." I think they're more responsible, and I think that's contributing a lot to declining death rates from traffic accidents. Just like their decisions not to smoke. And we're at an historically low level of teen and young persons smoking will, in the long run, contribute to a lower rate of death from cancer. So those are sources of hope. So it's a combination of technology, but probably even more important, ideology, in the sense of people making decisions and in internalizing norms that say, I won't drink and drive, I won't smoke, et cetera.
Luke, any downward fear ratcheting advice in 2016?
Well, this is maybe a slightly weird answer to your question because it doesn't change whatever my personal safety is. But for me, living my life in a way that I'm okay with it potentially being over at some point, and the relationships that I have, you know, with my kid and my wife and my family and just people I meet on the street, I'm not saying that I nailed it in 2015, but just connecting with this idea that we're not all going to be here forever and we should just try to pass on as much love and understanding as we can while we're here, it makes me less afraid of dying.
I've been having this exact conversation. I don't know if it's because I turned 50, and so did our buddy Hugo. But this has been this is lunch conversation, Luke. We'll have to talk about being close to death some other time. As fun as it is, and it is fun. Listen, I want to ask about quickly about how in 2015 the Seahawks won 99% of the Super Bowl against the New England Patriots, followed by what's known as the worst call in Super Bowl history.
Russell is taking his time. Second down and goal from the one. Lynch in the backfield. Russell looks, throws inside. Oh, my God, it's picked off at the goal line. It's picked off by God Butler. Oh, my word, with 20 seconds left.
Everyone in the Pacific Northwest was devastated except Russell Wilson, who understood that it was God's will. This season, the Seahawks just barely made the playoffs as a wild card team. So, Luke, what's more fun, rooting for the top dog in 2014 or rooting for the underdog heading into 2016?
The top dog.
That's
no
more
question.
Fun.
Well, it's if I had the choice, I would take top dog status because you get a lot of – there's top dog privilege that comes with it. You get to play the games at home where your fans are screaming. You get to rest for the first week of the playoffs.
So you that rooted for Apollo Creed against Rocky.
I mean, yeah, if Apollo Creed was from Seattle and I grew up rooting for him, then yes. But it's also fun to be an underdog, and I remember a Super Bowl where the Seahawks were the overdog and they lost to the underdog Pittsburgh Steelers who barely snuck into the playoffs. So the Seahawks this year are a total enigma to me. They could race through the playoffs and win the Super Bowl. They could also lose by 40 points in the first game of the playoffs. I couldn't tell you which one's going to happen.
They have so many weapons in that sense. Okay, finally, as it's 12:56 here, I want to say some goodbyes. We said in 2015, goodbye to the Woodland Park Zoo elephants, the Shell oil rig. The Kalakala finally had a steak driven through its aluminum heart. Some Seattle restaurants said goodbye to tipping. Are you saying goodbye to tipping 15 or 20% in Seattle, knowing that minimum wage is rising? No, Igioma, that's a scowl on your face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
That's one of the hardest jobs out there. And $15 an hour, by the way, in Seattle is still not nearly enough. So I will continue to tip like a good person in the world.
Anything you were glad to see go in 2015?
I was really glad that we had a reprieve from the duck terrorizing everybody on the Aurora Bridge. I drove that route every day this summer when I was teaching writing to youth. And every time I was thinking, this is the worst thing in the world. And my son, my oldest son, is getting ready to drive soon. And my biggest fear was that he would ever come in contact with that. I'm heartbroken that it had to happen in the way that it did, with the loss of life that we all saw coming. Anyone who's driven that bridge and come into contact with that behemoth that seems to be driven by people with absolutely no care for the width of the road is I'm glad we got a reprieve. I'm sad to see that we may well be getting it back out on the road.
You know, you told me before the show that you were glad to say goodbye to dieting.
Oh, yes. Yes. That was my thing this year that I did. I woke up, you know, January 1st of this year and said, nope, I'm just going to be fat and happy. And
how's that worked out?
Oh, my gosh. This was the best year of my life. It was wonderful. I say, you know, getting rid of that, looking in the mirror and not obsessing about things, throwing my scale in the garbage, you know, redefining my net worth to the thoughts in my head and the words that come out of my mouth instead of how much space I take in the world, and just being comfortable to take up as much space as my butt needs has been absolutely life-affirming. I've been able to dedicate myself to things that I truly love without that anxiety. I can go out in public without worrying and sucking in my stomach, and, you know, I can slouch as much as I want. It's been a wonderful spring year. I highly recommend everybody out there get as fat as you can. And don't care.
Listen, we got less than 2 minutes left. Luke, I think of you as quite a dieter. I mean, you talk about it a lot on your excellent podcast, TBTL.
Stomach in right now.
Yes.
And I'm not even kidding. Yesterday, I bought that stupid P90X workout. So
what?
I can
what
start
do you mean
it on
stupid?
January
it's
2nd.
Awesome. It's awesome. Well, I've been doing it for 5 years. It'll kick your ass.
I wish I could be as zen as it sounds like Igioma is being about it. Here's what I'm hoping we can leave behind back in 2015, which is the amount of internet outrage that we've all been living with.
Oh,
I can't think of a time where somebody getting mad on the internet has changed anyone's opinion. And to the degree, or in connection with what Igioma was saying about community, maybe the next time we are thinking about posting a rant somewhere, we could just walk outside and find a person and have a conversation with them. I think that's has a higher chance of actually changing an opinion than all of us just, and I include myself in this, just getting worked up online.
Okay, we're out of time. Rob McKenna, I assume New Year's resolution, state income tax, right?
Flossing, actually. I resolved to be a better flosser the past years.
That could have gone either way. Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General. Luke Burbank, host of Public Radio's Live Wire and the TBTL podcast. Igioma Oluo, Seattle writer, editor-at-large at TheEstablishment.co, and writer of the Badass Feminist Coloring Book. So great to see you all. I'm only sorry we have to say farewell to you in 2015, but let's say hi again in 16, okay?
Absolutely.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The year in review.